Good evening, and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Cubberly Theater in Palo Alto. My name is Dan Weiss. It is my pleasure to introduce Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. A graduate of Stanford University, Stuart Brand was a prominent member of the 1960s counterculture of San Francisco and helped spur the ecology movement of the 1970s. He founded, edited, and published the original Whole Earth catalog, which sold 1.5 million copies and was awarded the 1972 National Book Award. His previous books include The Media Lab, The Clock of the Long Now, and How Buildings Learn, What Happens After They're Built, which was made into a six-part BBC television series. In 1988, he co-founded the Global Business Network, and in 1995, he co-founded the Long Now Foundation, dedicated to encouraging long-term thinking and responsibility. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Stuart Brand.
Through trials and tribulations, thank you all for your patience and the luck that we were going to have some slides, because it was going to be interesting watching me try to dance these slides. A book just came out. Today's the pub date. Over here, you can legally buy them now. This book, The Whole Earth Discipline, sounds kind of like Whole Earth Catalog, and it bears relation, but it's really a different animal. Back then, when I started Whole Earth Catalog, just over here in Menlo Park in 1968, the Whole Earth name was sort of decorative, but this time I mean it. And we're basically talking about the planet's whole climate and its whole population. Now, I'm going to go through the stuff in the book like a bullet. I'm not going to be able to touch everything, and a lot will be missed, but it won't take very long. Just to establish my green credentials, when I was a small boy, I took the Conservation Pledge. At the age of 10, back in 1948, I said, I give my pledge as an American to save and faithfully to defend from waste the natural resources of my country, its air, soil, and minerals, its forests, waters, and wildlife. And I guess I stuck with that because I came out here to Stanford, majored in ecology and evolution, and went on, started the Whole Earth Catalog, was Mr. Natural for a while, and then by the late 60s, I was in a three-piece suit working for Governor Jerry Brown. And we put California on the course it now is, where we use basically half the energy that the rest of the American states do and about the same as European countries do. This book has a lot going on in it. But the sort of the news pegs that everybody notices is that it says that cities are green, nuclear power is green, genetic engineering is green, and in light of the seriousness of climate change and our unlikely ability to keep up with it, geoengineering is probably going to be necessary. I'll just visit that briefly. You've all seen the various hockey stick charts and so on. But one thing to seriously think about, and I bear down a lot on the book, is the many tipping points and hidden thresholds and especially positive feedbacks in the very nonlinear system of climate. And we don't know all of them yet. We keep being surprised. One of the positive feedbacks is the Arctic ice, which melted 40 years early. And as it melts, it turns reflective ice into dark absorbing water, and that makes the water even warmer and even less ice next year, and so it goes. These are serious matters, not just for polar bears, because what warming means is not only rising sea level, but drought. And drought is the civilization killer. We're watching that in process in North Africa now in Darfur, where carrying capacity has dropped enough so that the farmers and the nomads no longer like each other. They kill each other. And it's a process which may show too much of what the future is going to be like lots of places as droughts increase all over the world. A book I recommend, one of several I recommend tonight on this whole issue of carrying capacity and fighting, is a book called Constant Battles, Why We Fight. by Stephen LeBlanc. Not only droughts are going on, but here in the West and in places like Australia, forest fires are on the increase. And again, there's a positive feedback there. They put up a lot of CO2 and soot. They reduce the ability of the forest that burns to fix carbon, and round you go. A quite serious one that we haven't talked about much in the press here yet is the glaciers of the Himalayan Plateau. This is what they look like in Bhutan, but Bhutan is a tiny part of the whole Himalayan Tibetan Plateau. And what's frightening is that those glaciers feed the rivers on which 40% of humanity depends, the Indus, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, the Irrawaddy, the Yangtze, the Yellow River. This is where a whole lot of civilization happens, and it needs that water in the dry season. Two of the best books, I think, on climate to look at in these terms and others is The Vanishing Face of Gaia by James Lovelock, who's, you'll find, just laced all through my book, and this good book called 6 Degrees, which spells out what happens with each degree Celsius that increases in temperature. I want to look at what's actually going on with the world's population these days. It is increasing. It's slowing down its increase. Maybe level off, probably will level off by 2040 or 2050, around 8 or 9 billion. We have 6.8 billion now, of which 1.1 billion are in places like this, and 5.7 billion are in the developing world. In other words, the world's population, 5 out of 6 people are in the developing world, and they manage an enormous part of the land surface of the Earth, Africa, Asia, Latin America. They are on the move. They're on the move toward town. They're on the move toward opportunity. And here's a way to think about what's happening. Cities were, well, the numbers are, we were, how urban were we in a while back? 1800 is 3%. 1900 is 14% urban. It's now 50% urban, expected to be 61% by 2030, and 80% the way it is in the developed countries now by mid-century. Who's in those cities and where are those cities? The expectation is, and these are UN expectations, the 10 largest cities in 2015, 6 years from now, will be places like Tokyo, Mumbai, Lagos, Dhaka, Sao Paulo, Karachi, Mexico City. And you'll notice that all of those are in the developing world. They're growing 3 times faster and 9 times bigger than the European and North American cities ever did. One of the things we know from history is the world's largest cities are always the drivers of history. You look 1,000 years ago, and it was actually a pretty similar picture. The largest cities like Cordoba, Kaifeng in China, Constantinople in Turkey, Angkor in Cambodia. I was there, actually, a couple of weeks ago. Those were the big cities. They're all over the world. That's what we're getting to now. So in the last 1,000 years, which is historians call the rise of the West, the rise of the West is over, and the rise of the rest is what's coming on. And where they're doing is they're going to town. So urbanization is now the biggest event in terms of moving people in history. Every week, 1.3 million new people in town, some of them born there, most of them moving there from the countryside. What's the attraction? Opportunity and action. You're going to a place like this bustling squatter city of Kibera, which is outside Nairobi. And these are not people crushed by poverty. These are people very busy getting out of poverty just as fast as they can, and they are doing it. A good book for examining all of this I recommend is Shadow Cities by Rob Neuwirth. I'll mention these books again at the end if you want to keep track of them. And he went and lived in 4 of the major squatter cities in the world. Remember, 1 billion people, as he says in his subtitle, are in these places. That's a sixth of humanity coming up through slums. Another 1 billion people is expected in the squatter cities in the next couple decades. They're busy places. You go on to Delhi, there's a busy lane. You go on to Mumbai, there's a busy lane. You go on to one of the favelas in Rio, Rocinha, and it's a busy market. These are cities in the deepest sense, because they are places where you condense not only what are called the economies of aggregation, but it's a concentration of social capital, especially in the slums. Basically, everybody in a slum neighborhood knows everybody else, whether they want to or not. But that becomes a major economic event because, among other things, they can do what's called the informal economy. Without licenses, without property deeds, they just go ahead and have a city based on people knowing each other and dodging from the authorities and the tax collectors and so on. One of the standard figures is that in most developing countries, 60% of the economic activity is in the informal economy. You would think, well, that drags it down. But if you look at a place like Mumbai, which is considered to be half slums, it is also 1/6 of the measured gross domestic product of India. So those slums clearly are not dragging it down. They seem to be part of what's making the prosperity. Slum dwellers are famous for their resourcefulness, their ambition to move up in the world, and they'll create their own infrastructure. Just by plugging wires into whatever electricity is going by and generating it on their own. Now, part of what makes a city work is proximities. So if you look at Sao Paulo, a huge slum up against a major downtown area, and go right to the into the edge of it and examine what goes on there, what you'll see is, it looks like injustice, and it is. A very poor neighborhood, but very busy, right next to a very rich neighborhood, which all the swimming pools don't have anybody in them, at least at this time of day. So what's going on here is supply and demand getting as close to each other as they can. That's part of how cities work. And so the people who live on the poor part on the left here, which is a pretty interesting neighborhood, actually, that's the cooks and the nannies and the guards and the gardeners. They walk to work over in the boring, rich part of town. So these kind of proximities can get pretty rich. If you look at a slum market area in Bangkok, what you have is everything pressed right up against the railroad. I mean, you could reach out of the train and grab an apple as you go by some of these stands. The sound effect with this is... And the sound effect here is of people getting right back to work, bringing their stalls right into where the train was, and 10 seconds after the train has passed, you can't tell it was ever there. This kind of compression, this kind of overlap is what cities are great at. In Dharabi, the huge slum in Mumbai, a lot of the work there is the community for itself, but also a lot of the work is the community for the city at large. There's 4,000 recycling units in Dharabi, 30,000 rag pickers, and 6,000 tons of rubbish are processed in that slum every day. So you could say that the greenest of all humans in the world right now are the slum dwellers. They're the ones who use the minimal energy, minimal material, minimal food, and they recycle everything. That's worth thinking about what that means. They're green because they're poor, and they have no plan to remain poor. And if we say, well, you're so green, just stay exactly the way you are, they're going to say, oh, right, so you can have air conditioning, and we can't. That doesn't really work in the tropics. They are climbing... As they get out of poverty, they are climbing the food ladder toward more protein and better foods. They are climbing what's called the energy ladder toward more reliable electricity. And the picture here is a gentleman named Laxman Kumbi. He says, for toilet purposes, we have to go outside. It's a problem. We have to go in the road. The electricity is on for 2 days, then off for 2 days, or not on at all. We don't have much space for the children to play in. They use the road to play, and accidents take place again and again. I've not studied at all and am illiterate. For work, I stitch government jeans and pants. It's fine, but the workday ends late. I want to educate my kids. Until the day I die, I'll educate them. As long as I'm around, that's guaranteed. There's a billion people in the slums, like this gentleman and his wife and his two kids. A billion more in the countryside. They're coming into town to get to opportunity. One of the things they do in the slums is parents get together and have private schools started, just a couple of rupees a day. And people have looked at them and find that some of these private schools, very ad hoc, are in fact better than the public schools. So the general picture, global picture over the next 30 or 40 years is that you basically have the global south is full of new cities full of young people. And here in the global north, you have old cities full of old people. And where do you think the action is going to be? Many of the villages are emptying out. The ones that are staying, what keeps them in existence is by them connecting well economically to the city. So if you want to save a village, all you need is a good road, good cell phone connections, and by and large in the developing world, you can better get a better cell signal now in these wild and woolly places than you can in Palo Alto. And the reason for that is these people have figured out ways to make cell phones basically the platform on which they are learning how to prosper. The other thing villages need and don't have in most of the developing world is grid electricity. Part of what makes this process really green in the developing world is that the villages that were based mainly on subsistence agriculture are emptying out, and the old subsistence farms in vast quantity are being abandoned. That's great for the people because they're getting out of a poverty trap back into the cash economy by moving to town or by moving to where there's better land and doing cash crops and selling it to the new market in town on that nice road. So immediately the trees come back, the wild animals come back, the soil comes back, sometimes the aquifer comes back. One of the results of this, a number I came across that astonished me, is that we are still cutting down way too much primary rainforest. But because of this move to town, 55 times as much primary rainforest that is being cut down, 55 times more than that is growing back as second growth. And the second growth rainforest becomes quickly just as rich in all the species as it was before. So energy is a crucial element in all of this at global scale. It's a dispute we've been having in this country, and I'll get into some of it, particularly around nuclear versus coal, because right now the situation is that the only green baseload power, that is power that's on all the time, is hydroelectric dams and nuclear power. The fossil fuels, mostly coal and gas for electricity, dominate the market, and they are what are putting up the greenhouse gases. I had thought for a while that we could get 24/7 power from satellites beaming down basically solar power from space, but I'm persuaded by Elon Musk, who's in both the space business and the solar business, that that's probably not going to work. So for now, we're still stuck with hydroelectric and nuclear. If we can figure out a way to store the intermittent energy collected by wind farms and by solar collectors, that'll be swell, but so far that hasn't happened. Bear in mind, the developing world will get this electricity one way or the other, and you want to think about where that's going to come from. And meanwhile, in the developed world, bright lights is what a city is for us. That's not going to change. So when you come down to the choice between coal and nuclear, in the world, nuclear provides about 16% of the electricity and coal about 40%. Rather than go through the whole range of why that matters, let me just focus on the waste products of the two of them. One lifetime of using totally nuclear electricity would result in about a Coke can's worth of spent fuel. It'd be a heavy Coke can, but it's not a very large volume. Whereas every single day, a normal 1 gigawatt coal-fired plant is burning 80 rail cars of coal. Each rail car weighs 100 tons. You've got 8,000 tons of coal every day going into that coal-fired plant, and out of it comes 19,000 tons of carbon dioxide, no end of slurry, and fly ash. Now, where it happens to those two wastes? The nuclear waste goes into dry cask storage. Typically, 1 gigawatt plant will put out 2 casks worth. It's just 20 tons. It's pretty dense. Whereas a 1 gigawatt coal-fired plant a year is putting up 8 million tons of carbon dioxide, and it's not going into a place where you can keep track of it. It is going out into everybody's atmosphere where we can't so far get it back. And when you compare the lifetime emissions per kilowatt hour of various energy sources, obviously wind and solar are a huge improvement over coal and gas, but nuclear is right in there. It's better than both solar and wind by a slight amount. Now, if there's any question in your mind that whether it's really a choice between coal and nuclear, you can look at this ad from Australia where the coal miners were urging the Australian government not to go nuclear because then they would be out of work. You also want to look at nuclear in context of wind energy. Wind energy is a huge infrastructural apparatus by now with really huge turbines attached to increasingly high towers and 300 to 500 foot diameter blades. They are attached because the wind is not usually where the people are, to very, very long power lines. And in places like Denmark and Germany, which are pushing the edge of what you can do with wind, the limiting factor for them now is starting to be that they can't put up enough power lines. A peculiar thing on solar is what's called the footprint issue. And I learned about this in part when I'm a member of the California Native Plant Society. And I got a flyer by email that said there are 80 solar projects looking to put solar collectors on 1,000 square miles of Southern California. And we native plant protectors should make sure that doesn't happen. And the reason is that the desert, what many think is an empty and insignificant place, it is a place of great richness and all sorts of endangered species and a beautiful place to go. And it gets absolutely hammered, basically bulldozed flat when you put in solar. And this particular photograph, we'd say, well, they would never put solar in a beautiful place like that, except if you look at the Google location on where it was taken, it's right out in the middle of what looks like nowhere, exactly the place that these solar things will go. Add it all up, and a gentleman in the East Bay named Saul Griffith has figured out that we currently use about 16 terawatts of power to run civilization. Most of it comes from combustion of coal and oil and gas. Getting the atmosphere to level off at 450 parts per million, which we hope will keep the rise to maybe 2 degrees Celsius, which will be catastrophic enough. To do that, in the next 25 years, we have to replace 13 terawatts of that power source with new clean energy. And Saul Griffith points out that, yeah, you can do it. In 25 years, you need 30,000 square miles of solar electric panels, 15,000 square miles of solar thermal panels, 2.6 million wind turbines in good locations. That's about 100,000 square miles. If you really get maximum biofuel out of seriously engineered algae, you might be able to get 2 terawatts of electricity out of 1.5 million square miles of algae. 2 terawatts of geothermal adds up to 27,400 steam turbines. And to round off the numbers, he put in 3 terawatts of nuclear, which would be 3,900 1-gigawatt reactors in 25 years. You add it all up, and what you get is an area basically the size of North America to make clean energy under the present program that we're trying to pursue. A book that is very good on this, I recommend highly, is called Sustainable Energy by David McKay. He's an English, he's a professor at Cambridge in England. Now, another subject comes up all the time with nuclear is good old Chernobyl. It was indeed the worst accident in nuclear power history. 57 people died, 9 of them children, from a thyroid cancer that turned out to be curable and was. 47 workers, many of them heroic, knowing that they were going to die and doing the work to head it off. But if you go to Chernobyl now, it is the best wildlife refuge in all of Europe. The wolves have come back. They've reintroduced the prehistoric horse, the prehistoric bison of Europe, and it is a thriving area. A zoologist named Robert Baker, who worked there for 15 years, said it can be worse. It can be said that the world's worst nuclear power plant disaster is not as destructive to wildlife populations as our normal human activities. In other words, when they stopped farming, they moved out of town, they just moved out of the area because of worry about radiation. The animals moved in, were not worried about radiation, and turned out not affected by it. And so it's now a beautiful wild area, and I predict that it will be declared a national park pretty soon, and should be. Now, another issue that comes up a lot with nuclear is what about the proliferation issue? And that is a genuine one, and I'm going to do one simplistic thing here, is point out that so far nuclear has done more to disarm the world of nuclear weapons than any other thing, because this project that very few people have heard about called Megatons to Megawatts, the U.S. government is buying up warheads from Russia and reprocessing them, diluting them basically down into fuel, and about half of our nuclear power, in other words, 10% of all of our power comes from reprocessed warheads from Russia. And soon enough, we'll be doing the same with our warheads, so it's actually a pretty good deal. The issue on spent fuel is we thought, well, we'll put it in Yucca Mountain, but that's out, and it's been zero budgeted. So where is all the spent fuel from 40 years of nuclear power in the U.S.? It's in dry cask storage, same place in most places in the world. If you go to a reactor site out back of the parking lot, there's these 10-foot wide, 20-foot high things standing around. You can go be photographed next to it, and that's where all of the seemingly dangerous spent fuel is, and it's perfectly safe there. It's fine there. That's where we can leave it for 40 or 50 or 60 or 100 years while we think about whether we want to bury it or reprocess it or use it as direct fuel in the new generation of fast reactors. But if we decide that we do want to bury it, we've already been burying nuclear waste for 10 years in New Mexico near Carlsbad in the WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, and it's working very well. It's down half a mile in a 3,000-foot thick salt formation. It is very easy to mine, quite beautiful down there, and it has the quality that it heals in on itself. I'm borrowing a slide from the guy who's responsible for all of the environmental monitoring of the WIP, and he's pointing out a number of things that makes salt such an ideal place to put nuclear waste if you really want to just put it somewhere and forget about it. The Salado Formation covers four states, 3,000 foot thick. It has been there for 250 million years, and it's not going anywhere, and water doesn't enter it or leave it. So anything you put there basically is entering this geological time frame. It's a good place to leave it and not worry about it. A good book on all of this is Power to Save the World by Gwyneth Cravens. Now, I'm treated as some kind of maverick going against the stream saying nuclear is good, but actually I'm joining a growing list of people. It includes James Lovelock, John Holdren, who's the science advisor for the president, Jared Diamond, who was persuaded by John Holdren that nuclear is important, Tim Flannery. Did I hear that Tim Flannery's going to talk here? Is that the guy, the Australian biologist? Wow. Ask him about nuclear. He keeps adjusting his opinion on it. Paul Hawken used to be anti-nuclear. He read my book. Now he's pro-nuclear. Jesse Ossible at the Rockefeller University. Patrick Moore is one of the founders of Greenpeace. He has a PhD in ecology. He left Greenpeace when he thought they'd turned anti-science. Both Al Gore and Bill McKibben are not outspoken in terms of nuclear, but both of them acknowledge quietly that, one, we should keep the nuclear we have, and they both expect nuclear to grow, and they're not sorry about that. A good example of what this change is like is a fellow named Stephen Tyndale, who was director of Greenpeace in Britain from 2001 to 2008. And he got freaked by basically the realization that methane was going to come foaming out of the melting tundra. And he said it was kind of like a religious conversion. Being anti-nuclear was an essential part of being an environmentalist for a long time. But now that I'm talking to a number of environmentalists about this, it's actually quite widespread, this view that nuclear power is not ideal, but it's better than climate change. Then there's James Hansen. In a week or so, October 24th, there's going to be this big event that celebrates a number that he generated, saying we've got to go down from the 387 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to 350. 350 is the huge rallying cry, and it's a good one. People are going holding up all these pictures, and they're going to have them for all over the world, and it is an attempt to do kind of an Earth Day to persuade our national governments to get moving on dealing with climate change. Same guy, James Hansen, the beginning of this year in January 2009, wrote an open letter to the incoming President Barack Obama. He said, coal plants are factories of death. The danger is that the minority of vehement anti-nuclear environmentalists, in quotes, could cause development of advanced safe nuclear power to be slowed, such that utilities are forced to continue coal burning in order to keep the lights on. That is a prescription for disaster. One of the things that the Greens have gotten away from is taking government seriously. And I think now we're realizing that in order to get any kind of handle on dealing with climate change, basically at least four major governmental areas, the European Union, United States and Canada, China and India, all have to do the right thing in terms of making coal expensive, in terms of working with all the renewables and whatever it takes to mitigate greenhouse gases and do all the other things we're going to need to do with climate change. Now, as it happens, again, staying somewhat on the subject of nuclear, they are booming all over the world. Countries are getting their first reactors, everybody from Albania to Bangladesh. They're adding reactors, everybody from Bulgaria to Taiwan. And there are a number of countries that are increasingly serious about considering reactors. One of the things that makes it possible for them to think about this is they don't have to get a 1.6 gigawatt reactor for $8 to $12 billion from Areva or from Westinghouse. There's starting to be what is called micro-reactors. One example is one that is being built right now. It's a 35-megawatt reactor mounted on barges that the Russians are building initially for because the ice is melting north of Russia. The so-called Northern Sea Route is opening up and is going to become a major shipping lane, and they're putting in ports all along there, and these floating small reactors will be the power source. Now, the difference is that a bigger reactor is about 64 times bigger than these micro-reactors. So, and this is all a form of what us environmentalists like to approve of as distributed micropower, which makes the system more adaptable, more locally controlled, and more adjustable in terms of the ability to change the amount of power that you're generating. So Toshiba is making a small 10 to 50 megawatt reactor they call the Super Safe Small and Simple. There's another one with another acronym coming out of Los Alamos across the bay called Small Sealed Transportable Autonomous Reactor, 10 to 100 megawatts. One that has gone commercial now and is taking orders called Hyperion, based in New Mexico. It's about $25 million for one of these things about the size of a car, goes down to the ground, 25 megawatts. Another company just north of us in Oregon, NuScale, is building a 45-megawatt reactor, very modular, so you can start with the 45 megawatts and completely light a smallish town, and then if it needs more energy, you bring in another module. One of the old players in the game who built all the naval reactors for 50 years, Babcock and Wilcox, is coming on with a 125 standalone reactor. And there's some really radical things in coming, such as thorium reactors that are basically you build them, you put them in the ground, and thorium is much less troubling material to work with, and you can just leave it there in the ground forever when you're done with it. That's probably too much on nuclear. Let's go on to another slightly vexed topic of genetically engineered food crops, GMOs, as they're sometimes called. I think this is romantic environmentalism at its worst, because it's a fear of vampires. It's a visceral fear of something that's seen as unnatural, and then various biological ideas are put forward that that's why this is going to be harmful. It's really unnatural if you don't know biology, but biologists are pretty comfortable with everything about genetic engineering because they know that genes have been swapping genes, or that microbes have been swapping genes around promiscuously for 3.5 billion years, and we're just starting to catch up with their sophistication in doing that. It's been around for 10 years now. All of the environmental organizations I know are still either adamantly or somewhat opposed to genetically engineered food crops. And it strikes me as crazy because the major environmental biologists like Peter Raven or Edward O. Wilson just think it's a weird distraction. So who really likes genetically modified organisms? Well, the Amish, who are suspicious about all technology, but they dearly love BT corn. My friend Kevin Kelly was visiting a farmer, and he was figuring out what crop to put in next year, and his father was there and said, if you don't put in BT corn, I'm not even going to help you with that crop. It's just a waste of your time. And likewise, around the world, one of the things that's happening is as soon as environmentalists and European environmental organizations back off a bit, the developing world swarms ahead on this because tropical agriculture is a really different animal than the one we're used to in the temperate climate, and there are very specific problems that are best dealt with through genetic engineering. And so while we don't eat sweet corn that is engineered here, that we eat feed corn that is, in South Africa, the much-loved white maize is genetically engineered. I'm going to recommend a couple of books in this regard, one from by Sir Gordon Conway, who was part of the Green Revolution of Borlaugs back when. He's the guy who, Conway was part of inventing what's called integrated pest management. And his book, The Doubly Green Revolution, which is to take technical advances and, as he says, build ecology in the seed. And so use genetic engineering to make everything about agriculture in the world fairer and better for the environment. Local talent, the organic farmer named Raul Adamczak and his wife, Pamela Ronald, did a wonderful book called Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. And a good overview is Mendel in the Kitchen by Nina Fedoroff, who is a geneticist herself. She also is a close assistant of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And it's interesting that she kept on because she got that job for Condoleezza Rice, and apparently was so good at it, they kept her. So the GM crops, the genetically engineered food crops, are the biggest success story in agriculture in a very long time, basically the best thing since hybrid crops were invented. They've taken off everywhere in the world. They are green for various reasons. One of them is that the herbicide-tolerant plants, like Roundup Ready soybeans, now most of the soybeans that are grown, they've gone from tilling the fields to deal with the cover crops and the weeds and so on, the way organic farmers still do. Now they don't till. They don't have to till. And so the soil gets richer and richer from year to year. Drastically reduces pesticide use. The various BT crops, such as cotton and corn, have way less pesticide being used. And when yield goes up, you can have more land remaining wild. Genetically engineered food crops are now being moved toward not just being good for farmers, but good for the people who eat the food. And so rice, which half the world lives on, is severely deficient in the precursors for vitamin A. And so a couple of Swiss scientists did some pretty heroic engineering and came up with golden rice that does provide that vitamin A. It went through two generations. It's now finally 10 years later in field trials in the Philippines and expected to start spreading in Asia in the next year or two. It was held up all that time by my fellow environmentalists who, because they objected to the way that this particular plant was made, this breeding, it's basically a precision form of breeding to move, in this case, a couple of genes, one from a daisy. It's part of what provided the golden look. And that's what provided the precursors. If you really want to see a good book on what happened, is a book called Starved for Science, How Biotechnology is Being Kept Out of Africa by Robert Paarlberg. And it's an atrocity story. It's environmentalists have sinned. We have caused deaths. We have hindered science. And I think we have to stop. Mostly it's in Europe. Some say it's for protecting the French and European food crops from having to buy food from Africa. But in England, the Newfield Council on Bioethics met twice and examined in great detail the use of genetically modified crops in developing countries, and they said there's a moral imperative for making GM crops readily and economically available to people in developing countries who want them. I'm going to move somewhat from that because it's all connected. Now, here's the soil connection. I'm going to talk about geoengineering, and you can start thinking about geoengineering by thinking about what earthworms do in the soil. This is something that Darwin spent years discovering, and he was the person who discovered that earthworms basically create good soil. So they're referred to as an ecosystem engineer. It's a new term of art in my business that basically means that this is what's called niche construction. You've got an organism that is basically creating a better environment for itself. And in the process, creating an environment that is much richer for lots of other organisms as well, without all doing no harm to itself. We would all like to be ecosystem engineers. Another famous one is the beaver. Beavers make beaver ponds, and though they cut down a few aspen to make them, the ponds become habitat for no end of rich life. A very generative ecosystem engineer that inspired me and lots of people is Aldo Leopold. And back when he started doing restoration in a frapped-out farm in Wisconsin, Sam County, started in 1936. And you go there now, and all those trees he planted has become a forest. And, in fact, there's now a wonderful Aldo Leopold Center there where people go and learn how and get inspired how to do restoration. It's just a shift of scale, and I take two chapters in the book to make it, but I'll make it in one slide here to think about humanity's niche is the Earth, and our niche construction so far has gone kind of astray, and so we have some responsibilities to undo the harm that we've started doing, such as with excess greenhouse gases. One of the ways that what we need to have on the shelf ready if we get desperate is direct intervention in climate, what's called geoengineering. And my expectation is that we will come to that sooner than we expect because the cost of mitigation, the million square miles of renewable forms of energy will be seen as tremendously expensive and destructive in its own right. So mitigation, keeping it down to 350 or 450 or maybe 550, parts per million probably won't happen, and we'll begin to realize that. We keep getting bad news from climate because we keep discovering new positive feedbacks, for example. As the scientists get more and more data, some of the data is reassuring. Most of it turns out to be alarming. And one of the attractions of geoengineering is at least some of the schemes turn out to be surprisingly cheap, surprisingly rapid, and surprisingly reversible. The one the climatologists all like is what you can do if you make an artificial volcano. As we learned with Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991, it sent up 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide, like volcanoes do, 20 miles up into the stratosphere, spread out there, and that dimmed basically the planet for a year. Then the entire Earth's temperature went down that next year, half a degree Celsius. There was more ice in the Arctic. There was more polar bears. And the that year's polar bears were referred to as the Pinatubo cubs. This is a case of success. It's what they call a natural experiment. This is successful geoengineering. Could we do something like that? And the answer is looking to be yes. It might cost somewhere between $1 billion and $30 billion a year to put that kind of quantity of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. You would start locally, like in the Arctic environment. You would start low in the stratosphere, so if you didn't like the effects, it would just fall out in a few months, and then scale up if it does the kind of things that you want. Another scheme is brightening the Earth's reflectance by brightening ocean clouds with this incredibly cool vessel designed by Stephen Salter, an engineer in England. I went to a meeting with these guys. John Latham is the one who came up with the idea that if you atomize seawater and drive satellite-guided robot trimaran sailboats around with a turbine underneath that's putting the energy in to atomize the seawater. The atomized seawater goes up, it dries immediately into a little salt crystal, that becomes the nucleus for a water droplet, and this thing, a fair number of these things cranking up and down in the ocean, can brighten the clouds thereby, brighten the albedo of the Earth. And the expectation is that if you can reduce the sunlight that hits the Earth by 1.5%, that will keep the Earth at the temperature we like, even if carbon dioxide in the atmosphere doubles. So it's going to look pretty attractive. A completely green idea that was started by the Amazon Indians many years ago is instead of burning your agricultural and timber residues, just smolder them, just pyrolyze them into charcoal. Put the charcoal into wherever you got crappy soil. It turns it into pretty good soil, over time into very good soil. And the carbon that you sequester that way stays in place, making good soil. For so far, the oldest sites they've found are 4,000 years old. It could be done on a massive scale. Whether it can really scale up enough to make a difference overall remains to be seen, but it's one of a dozen such schemes that are out there. This one's obviously particularly benign. Because we are ecosystem engineers, badly so far, hopefully well pretty soon, that's why the climatologist Paul Crutzen, who got the Nobel Prize, describes our era geologically as the Anthropocene. There was the Holocene for 10,000 years, and now the Anthropocene, which is we are doing things that are visible in the geological record, not as traces, but as big events. And our range of responsibility now extends out into geological time frame. And the first words back in the Whole Earth Catalog was, we are as gods, and might as well get good at it. What I'm now saying is we are as gods and have to get good at it. Because climate change is forcing a change in environmental thinking. And the reality of what's happening in the developing world is forcing a change in environmental thinking. I think the shift is from ideology to pragmatism, from romantic identification with nature to scientific examination of nature. You keep your love, but you study what you're loving. And moving on to an engineering approach to things. We are going to have to take on ecosystem engineering at planet scale. We already are. We need to get enough science and enough engineering skill to do it right. So what I'm saying is that ecological balance is too important for sentiment. It requires science. The health of natural infrastructure is too compromised for passivity. It requires engineering. And what we call natural and what we call human are really inseparable. We live one life. Thank you.
There's the books.
Next slide. Can we get the house? Yeah, great. Thank you.
So, Stuart, it's a pleasure to join you here on stage tonight. You've given us all a lot to think about, certainly some very provocative thoughts. One of the things that you talk about is that ecological balance is too important for sentiment. Mm-hmm. It requires science. A question for you on that is, if we do away with sentiment, are we stripping away some of what moves us to preserve and protect the natural world?
No, I don't think you do away with sentiment. That's where all the motivation that you want to protect the natural environment comes from. And it's no accident. I learned recently that the major funders of the various environmental organizations are people who hike a lot. And one of the problems they're facing these days is, for some reason, people are hiking less, which means they're funding less. So get people back out in the bush. Something happens when you're really in nature. And in a sense, you know, the poet loves the tree. But is the romantic view is to sort of look askance at the tree's genome. It's either not interesting, or it sort of leads to dangerous thinking, or whatever it is. The scientist loves the tree and the genome and wants to sequence it, understand it, and in examples perhaps like bringing back the American chestnut, tweak it so that the fungus that killed all American chestnuts early in the last century can be defeated, and the American chestnut, which got up to 40% of the eastern woodland in this country, can come back. That's the combination of both sentiment and science and engineering that I'd like to see.
So then on a related note, you talk about how cities are green. They act as population sinks, helping to drive down population growth. What do you think is the environmental impact of converting open space to develop city?
That's interesting. You know, where the birth rate is dropping greatest, there is no open space. This is 11 people to a shack, and then, you know, 4 feet away is another shack with another 11 people in it. They would like to have open space, but often what they've moved into is, as we saw here, railroad rights of way, parks. So I think there's an urban sequence that starts very, very dense, and you know, if you can keep a few spaces intact, that's often done militarily. In Tokyo, you've got the emperor and sort of the yard around the emperor's palace. In the Bay Area, you've got a lot of ex-military land, which now is park, but the military kept it, you know, behind the chain link and barbed wire fence for many years. So I think open space is essential in sort of the probably second, third, and fourth stages of a city. But in the initial stages, it's a luxury.
So one of the other quote-unquote heresies is your argument about nuclear. Mm-hmm. And you've gone from stridently anti-nuclear.
Nah, mildly anti-nuclear.
All right, mildly anti-nuclear. to pro-nuclear.
To mildly pro-nuclear, and then as I dug into the material more, strongly pro-nuclear, and I guess pretty vocally pro-nuclear. I hope I'm not strident.
So what was the turning point for you on that issue?
Well, as Stephen Tyndale was saying, there, you know, there's, I think a lot of people have this kind of creeping suspicion that the facts are changing and they need to revisit. Most people who are against nuclear kind of made up their mind about it quite a while ago and have been acting on the frame of mind that they started then. And to revisit a frame of mind that you've been living according to for 10 or 20 or 30 years sometimes is at first worrying and then actually kind of refreshing. And then you get into information, discovering things like these microreactors and so on that you find you might be able to get enthusiastic about, or that radiation is not the profound hazard that we thought it is, or that burying nuclear waste is not as difficult as we thought. And in fact, We probably don't want to bury it because there's other uses we can make of it. Each of those sort of stages of discovery takes you through, as it took me through, another increment of saying, well, you know, under the circumstances, maybe it's okay. And, I mean, for me, for random reasons, I happened to visit, what does that 10 mean? 10 minutes to go in the world? Wow. Good, thank you. I happen to be in Yucca Mountain with the board members of the Long Now Foundation, and we weren't there for any political or technical reasons other than that we wanted to see what a mountain in Nevada with a hole in it was like, because we wanted to put a 10,000-year clock on a different mountain in eastern Nevada and put it inside. I just wanted to know what spaces inside Nevada mountains were like. And we discovered this, we learned a few things, but the main thing we learned is that it was bizarre that at that point, I think $6 billion had been spent on what was basically a $100 million hole in the ground with no end in sight in terms of defining whether it would be used. And the arguments had become so surreal on both sides of the debate that just being there forced me to sort of think about, okay, just a minute, 10,000 years. And, you know, our deal, the Long Now, is the last 10,000 years and the next 10,000 years. So you would think that thinking about burying spent fuel in 10,000-year terms would be a good thing. But as near as we could tell, it was the heart of the pathology at Yucca Mountain that led to these bizarre experiments trying to prove the unprovable and trying to plan the unplannable. And we realized that trying to define some set of activities for 10,000 years from now, for customers, for clients 10,000 years from now, when what we know is humanity will be weirdly different 50 years from now, seriously more different than that 100 years from now, and 200 years from now we'll either be, you know, hovering around with anti-gravity or wings built in with genetic engineering, or who knows what, or we'll have taken ourselves back to the Stone Age. In either case, a little bit of stray radioactivity easily detectable and dealt with out in the Nevada desert doesn't seem like the most pressing thing to put billions and billions of dollars into now. So something was bizarre about the thinking, and that helped move me in the direction I'm now at, where, frankly, if greenhouse gases were not an issue and coal was just simply doing all the vile things that coal does, without affecting climate, I would still be in favor of nuclear at this point. Look, it's not the total solution. It's, you know, part of a vast portfolio which we have yet to fulfill, figure out all the things we have to do to really mitigate greenhouse gases, but it seems like it's a big part of it.
Thank you for joining us tonight for Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Mike Mielke, Director of Environmental Programs and Policy at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, and we're joined tonight by author Stuart Brand, who's written Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto.
Can I add a footnote to that?
You can.
The footnote is that there are live footnotes and illustrations and everything that are not in the book online at sbnotes.com. And nobody's tried this with a book before. I'll be interested to see if you find it useful.
So part of your argument, as I understand or take it, is for nuclear, is predicated on the issue of storage and the fact that renewables like solar and wind are intermittent. I don't know if you heard, but recently George Soros, very recently, just invested $1 billion into clean tech. And there are
That's great.
Lots of venture capitalists right here in Silicon Valley that are betting that storage technology is the next big thing. What's your take? You mentioned that nuclear has its place for renewables.
Wind is clearly, all grown up. It's serious infrastructure by now. Solar is great on the individual level. I use it in four different ways in my life. And, you know, I didn't need any incentives. It just makes such good sense to heat a lap pool or to make electric fence that keeps cows out of a savanna that I'm helping restore or opens the gate in that fence. Solar is good on rooftops. Solar's good on the local level. So far, it hasn't added up to much globally because, the technology is still lagging and the intermittency issue that you spoke of is still huge in terms of managing storage. Solar thermal is a little better on storage than the rest. But the current numbers are that there's maybe 10 gigawatts total of solar capacity in the world. That sounds pretty good, except that it's only 14% effective. So it's 1.4 gigawatts of solar total in the world now, which is less than one medium-sized reactor. So it's got a long ways to go. I would love to see solar paint, solar windows, solar asphalt highways, plus while we're at it, paint the cities white so they're more reflective and also cooler, and every other damn thing. Plus, still in awe is the most effective way to keep out greenhouse gases out of the air is save with efficiency and conservation on energy. Just don't burn the stuff. I don't have much hope for what's called carbon sequestration, putting carbon dioxide down in the ground. I agree that some people are saying, well, you know, the best way to sequester carbon is leave the coal in the ground. It was sequestered before. Don't screw with it.
So one of the things that you also talked about, which sounds gee whiz and totally science fiction, is this idea of geoengineering, because we are up against it. But you also did mention in your book and in your presentation this evening that when we're dealing with systems that are as complex as the whole Earth system, there are positive feedback loops, tipping points, etc. And certainly coming to grips with that and the fact that there will be winners and losers and the benefits and costs will be distributed unequally across the globe. How do we deal with that?
I don't have the answer. I don't think we have any form of governance yet globally that can take on the fact that everybody's downwind of everybody else. And some of the geoengineering schemes are cheap enough that one nation, industrialized nation like, say, China or India or Russia, could just haul off and start doing geoengineering. And everybody else would probably say, in just a damn minute, is that an act of war you just generated? So there's another level of preparation that needs to happen. If we realize we need to do some kind of plan B, we need to do some suite of geoengineering schemes, you want to have the science in place so you know that they might well work, that you've done some incremental tests to sort of suggest that intended effects are happening rather than unintended effects, that the surprises you're getting are good surprises rather than bad surprises. For that, you have to start intervening somewhat. And you need to have the beginnings of a set of world-scale, world-shared norms about how we're going to talk about, how we're going to legislate about, how we're going to fund, how we're going to deal with the responsibility and authority of managing these geoengineering schemes. A fellow named David Victor here at Stanford, I think, has done some of the most realistic forethought in this area. And what he's encouraging is more funding to start moving beyond scientist notions towards some serious engineering, and a lot more meetings so that everybody who is thinking about and working on geoengineering knows everybody else who is, and there's a lot of transparency in the schemes that are going forward. And I would add a lot of permission from environmentalists to please go ahead and run those experiments and try those things and see if they work, because that's not the sort of thing you want to improvise at the last moment.
So again, thank you for joining us for a Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley event. My name is Mike Mielke, Director of Environmental Programs and Policy at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, and we're joined tonight, of course, by Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. So we're at that point in the program where we have time for just one more question. And I think you've issued a challenge to the environmental movement with your book. It's a clear call to action, but it's also a challenge. And one of the things that you've mentioned in your book and in some of your lectures is that the environmental movement is driven by two powerful forces, romanticism and science, and that they're in opposition. So in some senses, then, is the environmental movement at war with itself? And if we are up against it, with regards to climate change, what do we need to do?
I think when it's with the climate, we've been very well rewarded for taking the science seriously. The environmental movement failed to take the scientists seriously with genetic engineered food crops, failed to take the science seriously with nuclear, and needs to take the science seriously with geoengineering. So it's a move not to give up on the romantic and sentimental and emotional engagement with natural systems, but to add to it this other analytic and tweaking approach to natural systems. That's my point of, there is no difference between what is natural and what is human. They really are inseparable. And operating in that mode, I think, leads you to a kind of pragmatism. What I'm finding from early readers of the book is they refer to it, Edward O. Wilson referred to it as scary, and also exhilarating. Jim Lovelock, the Gaia hypothesis guy, who's been the biggest Cassandra in a way about climate, said that the book gave him hope. And I think it's because I just spent a couple of years looking at the various things that people are doing that are quite amazing and that you can really get your hands on. And it's not the personal tools of the Whole Earth Catalog, but it's the sort of society-level tools of science and engineering that give us, I think, give people a realization that, I like hacking around biotech anyway. I could be a green biotech hacker. Okay, that's cool. Bring it on.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Please join me in thanking Stuart Brand.
Thanks a lot.
We hope you all enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Stuart Brand, author of Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto, Mike Milkey, Senior Director of Environmental Programs and Policy at Silicon Valley Leadership Group, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.